John Salzberg, United Nations Association, National Capital Area. I'd like to pick up and support Mr. Bremer's, one of his points where he talked about taking the high moral ground. And in that connection, I'd like to mention, discuss the UN economic sanctions against Iraq. UNICEF estimates that 500,000 children have died as a result of those sanctions since their implementation. And of course, it has not really had any helpful effect on the persuading Saddam Hussein to undertake arms negotiations. So I'm wondering, what has been the value of those UN economic sanctions? And wouldn't we be advised to lift those sanctions in whole or in part in return for UN arms inspection, a thorough UN arms inspection visit to Iraq?
Problem, sanctions are always a blunt instrument, as I think Brent said earlier this morning, and as several of us have said. Of course, one could argue that the people are dying in Iraq not because of the UN, but because of the regime they have, which would be my argument. I think the lifting of the sanctions would be at this time premature. Even though it does create hardship, as UNICEF has pointed out, it seems to me it's justified in continuing our pressure on Saddam. I'm not one of these people who believes that the sanctions by themselves can do the job. I think in the end we're probably going to have to go in there militarily.
I'm not going to offer a net judgment about the wisdom of lifting or not lifting sanctions in Iraq. I just want to point out that in the long, voluminous literature that specialists in the academic world have accumulated, sanctions probably were pretty effective, and that was Libya. You know, it took several years, but I think most observers would agree that getting out from under the yoke of those sanctions, which were multilateral sanctions, there was a lesser degree of sanctions fatigue since it didn't directly target the Libyan oil industry, were a major factor in Gaddafi's decision to cough up the two Pan Am 103 suspects.
Sam? I'm Sam Lewis, American Academy of Diplomacy. I'd like to ask Mr. Peeler to talk a bit about the question of intelligence collection from this point of view. There's quite a lot been written recently about the difficulty of getting human assets into terrorist organizations in a world in which language aptitude is not the greatest notable quality of American society in particular. It seems clear that technical collection, electronic collection, has its problems now because the terrorists know too much about what we're collecting and they have other means of transmitting messages. What's your judgment as a professional intelligence analyst about the possibility of really greatly increasing human collection within terrorist cells and leadership groups?
There is very little possibility of greatly increasing human intelligence collection within terrorist cells. And when we say in cells, we mean in the circles that actually make the operational decisions, the places that would yield the sort of tactical intelligence that could actually be used to roll out terrorist plots. That is always rare, it always has been rare, it always will be rare for reasons having to do with the intrinsic nature of the target. Small groups, highly secretive, highly distrustful of outsiders, who through just a modicum of care and operational security can keep their plans hidden. And based on everything that's been uncovered over the course of nearly a year of investigation of the September 11th plot, we see that those plotters use those few simple but effective techniques. And try though we must, the number of truly well-placed sources that would enable us to collect the tactical information to roll up plots is always going to be very small. If you look at the post-mortem inquiries by the Crowell Commission after the embassy bombings, by the Downing inquiry after Khobar Towers, time and again we get the same overall conclusion, We had good strategic intelligence about the degree of threat that was being posed to us by particular groups in particular regions. We didn't have the tactical intelligence. We have a congressional inquiry that is still in progress. I don't want to prejudge what they're going to say, but I suspect their findings will have conclusions that that say something very similar.
Can I just comment on that, please?
Sure.
It is certainly the case that it is difficult to get good tactical intelligence, but it is also the case, as the Bremer Commission pointed out more than 2 years ago, that over the last decade, the CIA has run down its capability for human intelligence against terrorists, largely for political reasons. And we made a recommendation for changes in those guidelines 2 years ago. The Congress passed a law calling for those guidelines to be repealed in December, because even after September 11th, those guidelines were still in place. And a congressional committee, subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee, reported in June that as of the date that they reported, this June, those guidelines were still in effect. So I think it is clear that we have had a considerable amount of foot dragging on the part of our intelligence agency to get better human intelligence. And our commission also found that the CIA had become, over the last decade, far too dependent on intelligence from third countries. I do not agree with the argument that these groups are impenetrable. We had, after all, a California bubblehead who managed to get himself right into Al-Qaeda, allegedly even met bin Laden, and he didn't even speak the language. So it's not a language problem, Sam. I mean, that is part of the problem. It's a question of whether or not we're willing to take risks. You cannot have a good clandestine intelligence service unless you're prepared to take risks.
We don't want to drag this out, but my esteemed colleague has said a couple of things that cry out for a response. The bubblehead from California, you know, was a grunt who was toting a rifle on the front line against the Northern Alliance. And yes, he was reported to have met bin Laden. You know, I've met the president, but of course that doesn't give me an inside track on decision making in the White House either. The guidelines, which were the subject of one of the recommendations of Ambassador Bremer's commission, there's been a long dialogue on that. The fact is, and I can tell you from the inside as someone who was in part of the approval chain on this in a previous position, there's no instance that I am aware of a particular proposal for a recruitment from the field that was turned down by headquarters, or in which the delay in approval was so great it would have made the difference between a recruitment or not a recruitment. Some have said, and I think Ambassador Bremer has said, well, there's a chilling effect. This kind of preemptively turns off operatives in the field. That's not really an issue of guidelines and rules, but rather of making sure officers in the field are aware of the importance of getting, among other things, the buy-in of senior officials back here in Washington, which, if anything, would lower the risk to them as individual officers.
Wayne Berry, the American Foreign Policy Council. A number of commentators make a distinction between weapons of mass destruction and weapons of mass disruption, the kind of things we saw with anthrax, with the sarin attacks in Tokyo, and potential attacks by radiological weapons. And I would like any of the panel members to comment about how one deals with that distinction as a government. Weapons of mass destruction do require either direct or indirect participation by a state party, simply because of the industrial level infrastructure that is needed to produce them. But as we saw in this country, as the Japanese saw, you certainly do not need that kind of infrastructure to produce weapons of mass disruption. Are there practical ways that we as a government either can deter, can preempt, or can more effectively respond to that kind of distinction between those different kinds of potential terrorist threats?
Let me try to answer that. First of all, there may be ways to distinguish between the use of unconventional weapons, chemical, biological, radiological, or In to achieve effects of mass disruption or weapons of mass effect, as opposed to such weapons being used actually for mass destruction. What criterion we would choose to apply, whether it's a specific number of casualties I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure that it's in our interest to make a fine distinction between the two for policy reasons. In other words, I don't see an advantage in identifying a certain number of casualties or a certain measurable effect as the distinction between a weapon of mass destruction and a weapon of mass effect. That is something that we need to look at in the context of each potential event, or heaven forbid, each event that may occur. Second, I'm not sure that I would necessarily agree with the notion that weapons of mass destruction, if we're talking about larger number of casualties, require state participation. I think if we look at some of the frightening scenarios involving biological weapons, contagious diseases, that it is entirely possible that the event would quickly expand to the level of epidemic, even pandemic, without necessarily having the sophisticated processes and of dispersal that we would associate with a state. And again, I'm not sure it's always in our interest to make that distinction. We may choose to presume that there was state involvement. At the very least, every state that contemplates assisting terrorist organizations or using its own agents to employ such weapons should never be certain of our response. In other words, I don't want to set up too many criteria that give our potential adversaries a basis for anticipating response. Now, as far as deterrence is concerned, as I said in my comments, I think that we do want to establish a firebreak and to indicate that the use of weapons of mass destruction or weapons of mass effect will summon forth a very different response. We ought not to in advance include what that response will be or exclude anything from that response. Let there be no certainty on the other side. Final point. When it comes back to some of these more frightening scenarios involving biological substances, which have been a source of sometimes lurid discussion in this country, I don't believe any adversary in any part of the world should have any illusion that one can spread, in today's globalized world, highly contagious agents, and that these will affect only the American population. The reality is that such diseases, contagious diseases, will quickly spread beyond the shores of the United States and engulf the entire world. We, with our public health system, as weakened as it has been over the years, nonetheless will be able to cope with such outbreaks. So will the more advanced industrialized nations of the world. But when these diseases hit the developing world, that will result in a tremendous loss of life. And I think that kind of discussion, as cruel as it is a useful discussion to take place in many parts of the world where the use of such weapons are seen bizarrely as some way to obviate American power or to use as a means of offsetting
American conventional power. Beyond treaties, beyond deterrence, there are very good reasons that there are taboos, which are even more powerful, attached to the use of some of these weapons, because they will get out of control and hurt everybody. And that, to me, is a useful thing we can introduce into the international discussion to remind people that this is a sensible taboo that has existed for decades for very good reasons.
Alex Greninger, Center for International Security and Cooperation, Stanford University. I had a question for Dr. Jenkins. In your first point or element of strategy, you talk about the single-mindedness by which we must pursue al-Qaeda. I was hoping you could possibly clarify the single-mindedness and to understand how much plasticity is needed in our security policy response. I mean, we could say that during the Cold War we single-mindedly pursued Russia, and yet here we are today talking about this event, which was outside of that box. And I just wanted to understand how single-minded you should pursue al-Qaeda.
Single-minded is single-minded. I mean, this is, to me, the single greatest threat, immediate threat, to the national security of this nation. If there were another attack approaching the scale of September 11th, not the same scenario, but something approaching the same scale, that would have devastating impact on this country. Not simply in terms of the loss of life, but the psychological effect, the economic effects, the potential political effects. Another attack like that, or further attacks like that on this country, could cause fundamental political changes in our society. That being the paramount threat, then I think that becomes our paramount issue. Now, events are going to conspire to distract us from this, whether it's the crisis in the Middle East, or whether it's the confrontation in South Asia, or other events yet to occur. But we must keep in mind that for the immediate and foreseeable future, al-Qaeda, and by al-Qaeda I agree with Paul, that we're talking about something broader here. This is al-Qaeda, this is the son of al-Qaeda, this is the successor of al-Qaeda, these are the remnants of al-Qaeda. Again, I don't see al-Qaeda as a finite group. I see it as a process, as an enterprise, that the destruction of that enterprise must be the framework within which we address other issues. It is our focus.
Time for two more questions. Julius Friend, George Washington University. Given the importance of the single-minded emphasis on al-Qaeda as an enterprise, should we consider that the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize or to demonstrate hatred of the United States and its values, or that its primary purpose is to recruit by demonstrating that a hated target is vulnerable and to encourage people who want to do the same thing? I have observed this in terrorist groups over the last 20 years with very rare exceptions. Terror is not the primary purpose of terrorism. And to understand this is to show that if we undertake actions in the Middle East, particularly unilateral ones, we are recruiting people for the next generation or beyond it, which is exactly what Mr. Bin Laden, dead or alive, wants us to do. He would like to emulate Mohammed. He's given indications of that. Mohammed, between 622 and his death, created a world movement. Let's not make him Mohammed.
Take a
Let me just make a comment here. First of all, the purpose is both. The purposes of a September 11th attack or some of the other attacks that have been credited to al-Qaeda is to punish the United States. There's no question about it. It's to create an atmosphere of fear and alarm. It's to cause us to divert vast resources to protection against these attacks. This can emerge to be a very effective means of economic warfare against the United States, and we must respond to that. Second, at the same time, of course, it's a recruiting poster. It's intended to galvanize a constituency, to inspire others to action. And to a degree in the past, those actions have succeeded in sending a stream of recruits to Osama bin Laden's tent. If September 11th was intended to provoke us into an overreaction that in turn al-Qaeda could describe as an assault on Islam and thereby arouse the Islamic community to rise up and resist the West, that has failed. There was no mass uprising, and that is a frequent failure of terrorist organizations, that they vastly overestimate the willingness of their perceived constituencies, in some cases their imagined constituencies, to rise up. But whatever their expectations are, the fact is that this still requires a physical process for those recruits to join up, to go off to Afghanistan, to participate in that process, that sense of brotherhood. That required a physical process. We have disrupted that physical process. We can't ignore the longer-term political issues. I think we'd all agree that with military force, is not by itself going to succeed any more than physical security by itself will win the war. But we have to intervene to disrupt that process, to buy us the time to deal with some of these more fundamental issues.
I would just caution about any generalization about the motivation of terrorism is X. I mean, you have as many motivations and mixtures of motivations as you have terrorist groups, and even to some degree as you have individual terrorists. And not only that, but it evolves, the patterns and mixtures of motives evolve over time in much the way that Jerry Bremer described earlier.
Being very patient.
Audrey Kurth Cronin from Georgetown University. I wanted to ask a very broad question. I apologize, you can just take a piece of this if you wish, but it's about American strategy in the past year and as we move forward. People who study terrorism generally argue that we need, because it is such a broad-based threat, to have a broad toolbox of different types of responses. And over the last year, we've certainly moved ahead in areas like the use of military force, law enforcement, intelligence, increasing resources. People are arguing for better public diplomacy. We talk about increased homeland security, UN conventions, Resolution 1373. One American value is opportunism, and certainly we're putting a lot more resources in each of these areas, and people are very eager to continue that trend. My question is, looking at the tools horizontally, looking at across American strategy, where are our relative weaknesses and strengths, looking at our record for the last year? Where do we need the most improvement as we move forward? And what are the likely conflicts as we continue, given the fact that we have limited resources, both financially and especially politically?
Jerry, do you want to take this?
Well, first, you're absolutely right. A president needs to have the full spectrum of a toolbox, if you will, a full spectrum of tools available to him to fight terrorism. There's no one answer. It's not just diplomacy or economic sanctions. It has to be the full scope. I continue to think that, as I suggested, in my remarks, that one of the weaknesses is intelligence, particularly intelligence relating to activities of terrorists within the United States. And I think it's a structural problem that cannot be fixed by moving the chairs around at the FBI. The FBI is the world's best law enforcement agency, but it is a law enforcement agency. It's not an intelligence agency, and I think this is an area we're going to have to look at.
Thank you. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We could continue to debate these issues for the rest of the day. I want to thank you, all three presenters, for their excellent presentations. Please join me in showing our appreciation.